branding, experience, conversation, promotion, powerful marketing, empowering small business to change their status quo. It's the Internet Show, all about small business marketing. Jay Arrett hosts the brightest minds in marketing. Power, power to the power. Small business.
And it's episode number 68 of Power to the Small Business. Welcome. My name is Jay Arrett, consultant, blog author, speaker, and frustrated Dallas Cowboys fan. You found the Internet Show that brings you the brightest minds in small business marketing. Before we get to that, the vitals. My company website is themarketingspot.com. All the show notes and links from the podcast can be found at powertothesmallbusiness.com. And if you're into Facebook, my Facebook page is facebook.com/themarketingspot. Pretty easy, right? The topic on the show today is discipline and professionalism in marketing. And it's pretty cool how this episode came about, although this is not a marketer's roundtable episode. But this also shows you the power of Twitter. Because one day, I forget who actually started the conversation. I think it was Stephen Denny and I. We started talking about professionalism in marketing and the decline of professionalism in marketing. And then a couple others got involved. And before you know it, we had Emmanuel Brown in Portland, Mike Wagner in Des Moines, Stephen Denny in Santa Cruz, California, and little old me in Waco, Texas, all talking about professionalism and discipline in marketing via Twitter. So we thought we need to do this more in depth, and that's what today's episode is all about. Discipline and professionalism in marketing. I think it's on the decline, and we'll get into those reasons here in the podcast. A lot of what you're going to hear in this episode, you might think applies to bigger businesses, agencies, and I know we have some marketers who do listen to this podcast, but I encourage you to listen intently because there are a lot of lessons for small businesses here. Because small businesses tend to emulate the marketing of the big brands. And the quality of big brand marketing is publicly revealed through its advertising. And I'm of the opinion that most of the big brand advertising you see today is pretty bad stuff. And it reveals a lot about what's going on at the ground level, at the core of these marketing plans and what these big brands are doing. So please take a listen to this conversation and then join me on the other side, and I'll have some thoughts about how this applies to small businesses. So here we go, live on the Skype line, and our distinguished panel of guests today to talk about marketing professionalism and discipline. Let's go around the table and have them introduce themselves. We'll start off with Stephen Denny.
Hey, it's Stephen Denny here from Denny Marketing out in beautiful Santa Cruz, California.
Emmanuel Brown.
Hi, Emmanuel Brown, out in Portland, Oregon. I'm a creative technologist working independently.
And Mike Wagner.
Hi, this is Mike Wagner from White Rabbit Group. I'm the CEO of the company, and I'm here in Des Moines, Iowa on a beautiful fall day.
And I am your host, Jay Arrett of The Marketing Spot in beautiful Waco, Texas. Okay, so the four of us somehow, through serendipity, I think, we just got in this conversation on Twitter a couple of weeks ago about professionalism and discipline in marketing. And this was the first time that we could all get together at the same time. So here we are talking about it on a podcast. Let's talk about professionalism and discipline in marketing. And Stephen, you wrote a blog post on it this week, Why All Bad Marketing Research is Wrong. Get this conversation started here. What was your main point there? How does this apply to marketing discipline and professionalism?
We all saw the Old Spice campaign a few months ago now, right? This great marketing tsunami of self-congratulation. And you know, many of us looked at this, and by us, I mean those of us who came of age working for companies that leaned on us pretty hard to prove the worth of every dollar spent. To many of us, we looked at this and we thought, wow, you know, is this really going to do something? Is it really going to move the needle? And as it turned out, Ad Age, God bless them, began to report the facts once IRI started leaking that the sales of the product were a little bit lackluster. Now, I blogged about this, and people went nuts. People were literally insulting in their approach to this, what apparently was a very contrary view. And I began to wonder, and I was looking at this, you know, there seems to be a problem separating theater from the commercial aspects of commercials. And a lot of people are really blaming me for pulling back the curtain. And, you know, and I'm perfectly willing to sort of let that go. But, you know, you skip forward to the present and we see the Gap logo. And now we see a logo from a major consumer brand launched. It's thrown up on publicly. And the brand retreats. And understand, I was at Sony when they tried to kill the S mark. You know, the digital S on every piece of Sony equipment you've ever seen. The little dots. I was in the midst of doing packaging testing at the time. So I took this S mark. I tested it against real consumers and proved that this mark had huge equity, and by virtue of that, it survived. So I was wondering why Gap would retreat, and surely they did their homework, and it readily became apparent that they didn't. Now we're reading how brands are testing things on Facebook, how bloggers talk about testing creative in focus groups. That was really the point, the excuse for the blog post, and it really made me wonder if this preponderance of do-it-yourself tools is starting to make us a little bit lazy. We've lost the ability to do the math in our heads now. And comments on my blogs are suggesting this. I don't know. And that's what set me off. Do you guys agree?
So what you're saying, Stephen, is maybe it's the result of where we are now with all these online tools and social media and stuff like that, that is just causing a decline, would you say, in the professionalism and maybe the responsibility of marketing?
Once upon a time, these things were really expensive. You know, if you wanted to go make video, that was a high five-figure, six-figure investment. I mean, it was a big undertaking. And now it's very simple. You can grab a flip cam and upload it to YouTube and it's done. And I wonder, this is a bit rhetorical, if the fact that online survey tools, the fact that having a ready panel of people, and the air quotes are here on my end, you can't see them, but a panel of people through your Facebook presence or your Twitter stream, whatever it happens to be, makes it easy enough to turn to out of convenience, but is it really giving you what you're supposed to be getting out of it, which is projectable, quantifiable, robust, disciplined, you know, results?
Emmanuel, I think that Stephen's onto something in terms of the ease of use driving a bit of laziness. And a bit of magical thinking as well.
Mm-hmm.
I know that from the creative side, I've seen a lot of shortcuts taken, you know, driven from the client side through the creative, where, you know, the bigger, harder ideas that would normally be more expensive are frowned upon. Instead, they want to do something that's, you know, going to, you know, resonate well with the Facebook crowd, et cetera. So mm-hmm. What I think starts to happen is you get a bit of an echo chamber logic, where we know where our audience is, let's go talk to them. Well, half the time, you know, as I've seen, most of the executions that have come out that I've been firsthand witnessed had very little reasonable metric attached to it other than that. And so mm-hmm. After a while, you start to wonder, well, does our client actually know their audience at all?
Yeah.
Do they know the real audience? Or is this the audience of, you know, all the people that have signed up for their Facebook page, et cetera? So I think there's a lot of just magical thinking that comes in. So the metric needs to move, first and foremost. Needs to get communicated. And then secondly, we need to start to think about this in terms of what's the end experience. If easy is the way it's going right now, then what, you know, what's the opposite of that? You know, what is going to be the difference to make remarkable marketing experiences for people, to connect them to the brands and products and services that they're looking for?
So you're saying because it's just so easy to make bad marketing that people are making bad marketing because it's easier to make than making good marketing.
There's no accountability other than the fact that sales aren't happening, and people gloss over that really quickly, and they move on. You know, most of these marketing teams, especially on for the bigger corporate brands, and I've seen this firsthand, are moving through multiple campaigns at the same time. They're juggling so much stuff at one time that they can't actually put any quantitative focus on any of it, or qualitative rather. So it's just it's really getting to a point where I think, and Old Spice is a good indicator of this. Old Spice showed you that you had an agency like Wyden with enormous strengths in commercial capability and message, right? They know how to connect with people. They did that very, very well. They created an enormous amount of buzz that was completely unsustainable, and it drove to nowhere. So the sales, of course, sales didn't go anywhere, you know. Coupons or not, the fact is that you know, that level of engagement is impossible to sustain in that way. So you have to figure out what is the other way that we do this. And granted, their production value was very high, mm-hmm. but the mechanisms they were using were the same flip cam to YouTube kind of, you know, methodology that everybody else was going for to generate, quote-unquote, viral videos that create a lot of good feeling, but very little else.
This is Mike. I think that I look at this from the point of view of organizational development and more particularly leadership development. That's my background. That's what I bring to the table. And as I start thinking about this, I wonder about just the corporate cultures that no longer pass along the critical skills, the analytical thinking, the disciplines that you have talked about in terms of some basic things, things that Stephen talked about in terms of what is expected or historically been expected. It seems that because it's easy, because it's a tool that's a do-it-yourself tool for the most part, because there's a sense of urgency being created by our economic climate, no one is sitting down and saying, okay, so how do I mentor the next generation of marketers into the utilization of tools that still achieve the kinds of metrics, valuable information, and critically informed decisions that we used to get. And so to me, I think it's an indication of the diminishing of true professionalism and the disciplines that professionalism assumes just by the very nature of the term. I think that's going away. And I think, Stephen, I think maybe you mentioned at one point things that you learned, and you were able to give me a name of an individual. I learned this from these people, from these teachers, these professors. Yeah. I'm not sure that people are getting that kind of mentoring, and I think that's why they're off doing these crazy things.
I think you're probably right. The guy I was referring to, Howie Lipstein, was the head of marketing research at Sony when I was there. And he was referring back to his days at Wharton. He's a deep quant guy and very statistically based. And when we talk about non-sampling bias, which is that other sampling bias, the one that doesn't have to do with numbers, it really sort of addresses that issue of garbage in, garbage out. You can have 10,000 people in your sample, in which case you have a very low sampling error in terms of the statistical validity based on the numbers. The problem is you're not doing your job right. You need to be looking. If you read, for example, Jackie Huba and Ben McConnell, thank you. Citizen marketers, and they talk about the fact that, you know, it's that 1%. It's that 1% who stand up and comment online. 1% is not representative of 100%. It's representative of that 1%. So if you're going to be doing testing, skip forward to Gap, you know, they throw this thing up on Facebook and their Twitter stream, and that 1% have an opinion. Of course, now within that 1%, you've got bias as well. So all of a sudden, you're making decisions on a fraction of 1%, not the 100% that walk through your stores and buy your stuff. And that's terribly dangerous and terribly irresponsible.
Well, Stephen, I think you brought up the point in your blog post about focus groups, and you're talking mm-hmm. here about research. I'm reading a book right now called Consumerology. It talks about the marketing research myth. And basically, you can't really do good marketing research because unless it's live testing. The only really good research is live testing, because when you ask people, you know, or you try and get their opinion, they're going to give you their conscious answer or what they would like you to believe mm-hmm. or what they would like to believe themselves they would do. But when it comes down to the time of action, their unconscious decision is often in conflict with the conscious decision. And so trying to go by research is just a path that's just not going to get you anywhere.
I think you have to define research, and I think we have to be careful with this, because if we equate research with focus groups, then you're absolutely right. And if you equate research with a quantitative survey that you receive in the mail or you receive online that says, will you buy this product, yes or no, then you're absolutely right.
I want to get back to something that Mike said earlier about the next generation of marketers. And I worry about the current generation of marketers, because there is just so much bad advertising out there, bad marketing that's reflected through its advertising. Stephen, you brought up we've been talking about the Old Spice example there. I don't know what people were thinking. The whole point of the advertising was, look how great I am. Look at me. And it didn't connect with the users of Old Spice whatsoever. If you compare that to the Axe campaign, by contrast, mm-hmm. which is a great campaign and great branding, they're saying, hey, get chicks with Axe. And Old Spice was saying, you can't be as good as me. And I'm thinking, like, where is the logic in that? Who thought that was good marketing? And so you get this focus on the agency who comes up with these good ideas or these cool ideas, and they think that that's good marketing. One of the worst campaigns, I think, right now is the Dodge Journey campaign, where they compare the Dodge Journey to a monster truck, a tank, and an armored car. And then they ask the question, world's best vehicle? How about world's crappiest advertising? That's awful. So who is coming up with this stuff, and why is it so bad? Go ahead, Mike.
It seems to me that there is a breakdown again in how people are learning, what that looks like in terms of practice. The idea, for example, of confusing novelty, what you just described as a communication that's basically a novel communication versus a persuasive communication. And so we're doing novelty in terms of, hey, look at me, the agency that produced this, as opposed to anything that's genuinely persuasive. And back to what Emmanuel said, based on an agreed-upon target audience that we really want to reach, as opposed to the magical thinking that we're creating for ourselves.
I think there's been some good lessons that could have been learned as things have gotten more and more digital, especially from the technology side. When you look at some of the really great services and things that have kind of come out lately, over the past 5 years, I think of groups like the 37 Signals guys, or they came up with Basecamp and other tools, or even if you want to go big brand, think of some of the stuff that Apple's done. Both times they focus on the key benefits of the technology in terms of people, right? What are people going to get out of this stuff? And from there they start to build out, and in some cases take away, a lot of feature sets and things like this. In a lot of cases, with the campaigns, what I see is the exact opposite, especially the crappy campaigns. I see things that people are throwing everything into the blender, and to me that tells me that they're scared to death, like they really don't know what's going to work. There's nothing that tells them, instinctively, we know who we're talking to, and we know what they want to hear, and we also want to kind of push them in this one direction, like you're saying, persuasive. There's nothing there for them to glom onto. So people go, ha ha, that was funny, or that was the worst thing I've ever seen, or whatever. Or worse, they just tune it right out. I think that the technologists, especially some of these service levels that have come up, have shown a methodology that's been twofold. It's been, work quickly, put small ideas out there, see if they float. If they do, build upon that success and move forward. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is, really look at the hard data. What are people after? What are they here to do? You may have a great idea and a poor execution. It may be a poor idea and a great execution, and you suck people in either way. What you have to do is start to figure out, of all the people that we're working with and all these different groups, which ones are the real, like the real sweet spot group. It's almost like relying on the Pareto principle to bind, a certain level of, like case typing almost. It's like saying, who are the people that are going to generate the most value for our business? And let's concentrate our messaging on those guys. Who's the second level? Who's a tertiary level? And spread it out from there. And a lot of what the technology side does is that type of focus. And that's the way they test it is real world. They just let people go in, play with it, and it's long beta testing periods to work all the kinks out. Marketers aren't used to that, but there may be some good clues in there to start to adopt a kind of not fail faster, but put out little bits, more iterative, and start thinking about really gaining more information rather than just rolling out these big solutions every time and watching them fail.
Scale and test.
Well, Emmanuel, I was going to say, it reminds me of what you're saying of kind of the rapid development models that were created among programmers and coders. you're saying some of that same model needs to be applied in kind of a rapid marketing development, something or other. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. In fact, there's a little strategy agency here in Portland called Fight, and they were a bunch of guys who really got tired of watching great creative ideas or good marketing ideas, either one, go straight down the tubes because of, you know, too many chefs in the kitchen or what have you. Like, there's always some excuse, but one way or the other. So they got sick of that, and they started thinking about what is the root cause of this stuff. Well, one of the root causes was that you're seeing people, they refer to it as cupcakes versus wedding cakes, right? They keep wanting to roll out the big, beautiful wedding cake for every major marketing campaign, and these things roll out, and people go, uh-huh, great. You know, and they might have a nibble here and there, and they leave the rest of it there to just melt and rot. Well, the cupcake idea is different. You know, you put out maybe a few different little ideas, spread them around, see what works. Social media is good for this only because it helps to see how far an idea will go. It's not necessarily a great, you know, metric in terms of understanding who the audience is, but it is a good test case for the idea itself. Will this idea, does it have any legs? Will it spread? Will people talk about it? Okay, good. Then it's who's talking about it. And that goes back to what Stephen was talking about before. Is it just the vocal 1%? Are these people that actually, you know, will engage our brand or product or service? So I think there's some interesting ideas there about maybe doing a more iterative approach to some stuff initially to understand and calibrate the larger campaign and marketing focus.
The potential blind spot to the cupcake versus wedding cake idea is that you got to make sure that the cupcakes are going into a lot of different hands. Because, I mean, again, if I pull this back to a social media world and say I'm putting out, you know, small-scale tests in my Facebook following of, you know, 45,000 fans or whatever it is, gee, look at all the great comments I'm getting. That's not a test. That's good anecdotal feedback. That's good qualitative feedback. And it's nice to hear, but it's not something upon which you're gonna hang a conclusion. And I think that's the problem.
Yeah, I should clarify that I wasn't suggesting that social is the only place to go with this sort of technique.
Sure, I think that's
your point, too. You know, you need to get it out there in other ways. And like, you know, with the Gap, you know, I think that's a good example of where I think they allowed too much social media to influence, you know, the decision-making. And perhaps that's the case. It's clear they didn't really, I mean, the designers and everybody else flamed them, and it made an enormous pushback, and they felt embarrassed, et cetera. But, you know, in general, what was the larger reaction? Did they try and build a couple of just test stores to see how people reacted to the new brand identity? Did it make it easier for people to shop? I don't know. I mean, there's all kinds of other ways to qualify this stuff, and I don't think they really did any of it.
Sometimes this stuff happens just because a chief marketing officer thinks something needs to happen. Like, why did the Gap's logo need to be changed in the first place? And so you have turnovers of chief marketing. I forget what the lifespan of a chief marketing officer is for a large brand these days, but it's like under a year and a half. And every time the chief marketing officer changes, the marketing changes and the branding changes. I challenge you to tell me what is the brand identity of any of the three major beers out there, because it changes every single year with the latest, what they think is the best idea. I remember last year, what was it? Bud Light was drinkability. Mm-hmm. And yeah. I remember the inimitable Laura Reese wrote a post talking about, this is it. Bud Light has hit on it. It's drinkability. And I was thinking, like, what the hey, drinkability? You mean we can stomach your beer? That's your message. And I commented on her blog that 1 year from today, drinkability would not be around. And so now we have, here we go where, you know, that'll be gone in another year too. So you have, there's just no consistency in all this marketing and branding, especially. I think this is what it comes down to, is nobody has a real brand and everybody's just looking for a good idea and floating things out there like Emmanuel and Stephen, you've been talking about.
You know, this is Mike. I would say that what I'm hearing is that there is no agreed upon target audience. There's no who behind this marketing initiative, whatever it might be. And so you can't really can't bring design sensibilities. You can't actually bring design disciplines to the project because you don't know who the cake is for. Let's use the cake metaphor. Is it for an 8-year-old boy's birthday party, or is it for a 25-year-old woman's wedding? Until I know that, any cake will do. It's just whose preference. It's the alpha in the room that says, I think it should be this, and that's what it should be. And I'm wondering, back to corporate cultures, back to leadership and organizational design, how are these businesses, are they fundamentally that broken that we're just seeing the necessary implications of internal dysfunctionality just showing itself in the way things are being marketed?
Well, guys, we are running out of time, so I think this will be good, because I bet we could go on for a couple hours, keep on throwing this thing about. But let's go around the table here, and you give your final thoughts on this. Maybe if you want to answer Mike's question there or give your own final thoughts here, let's just see where this is leading. So we started with Stephen. We'll give you first crack at it, Stephen.
You know, I think that the next great frontier of agency development is going to be knowing stuff. This is going to come back, and this is going to become a discovery in the next wave of agency development. All of a sudden, someone's going to park a little data gnome in the back, and that person's going to do really disciplined work, and we're going to find some causal relationships between the work that we create and the results that come out the other end before it happens, and we're going to hail this as a brand new discovery. Everything old will be new again.
Interesting. Okay, Emmanuel, what do you think?
I like that approach. I think that's starting to happen slowly but surely, too. I also think that there is, and I mentioned this before, I think there is some opportunity in hybrids right now. I think that, you know, taking some traditional deep knowledge of classic marketing techniques, what works, what's, you know, anthropological, and then moving that into the digital space and the fast and furious marketplace of ideas. I'm starting to think about, you know, maybe it's not about ripping the cover off the ball each time, but building success over time and building brand awareness and value over time by hitting, you know, key messages and building a larger perception in the audience's mind of meaning and quality and things like that, classic value. And starting to embed some of that more into the digital age would be a good opportunity.
Mike Wagner?
Well, and I would build on what Stephen and Manuel have said. I would say that we're going to see some of the implications of design thinking. People like Roger Martin, who's been writing about this out of Rothman, we're going to see that applied to the market world. And so that'll actually kind of build on this, you know, the step-by-step iterative approach and designing for a real person that we're imagining as being our target audience. And I would say, using an Old Testament metaphor, we're going to go back and dig the old wells and go back to some classic disciplines that have historically been there.
I'm going to be more cynical than you three and think that that'll happen some, but I think that largely it is what it is. But that will allow those who do go back to the classic market disciplines and realize that those are still valid today, that we just kind of got blindsided by all the new shiny tools. But if we go back to classic marketing disciplines like branding and not needing to make a big splash every time we say something, then those are the agencies and the marketers that will be successful. All right, guys, that was great. Thank you for your time. We appreciate you joining us here on, although we didn't talk any small business today, we did talk marketing. So thanks for joining us here on Power to the Small Business.
Thank you. Thanks.
So what does this mean on a small business level, a local level? You heard a lot of agency talk in there, big brand talk. Let's discuss some of this stuff point by point. First, scale and testing, meaning how can you test your ideas, your products, your brand on a level that will be representative of your entire customer base? And as you heard during the conversation, social media probably not the way to test your ideas and Gosh, I've been guilty of that myself, is turning to social media because it's convenient. I have about 7,500, 7,600 followers on Twitter, got about 500 on my Facebook page. And so it's easy to say, hey, there's 500 people, 7,000 people right there. Let me just ask them, but they're not representative of your customer base. So be careful about trying to test your ideas through social media. The only real good way to test your ideas is live testing. Testing it with your customers without them knowing that they are being tested. It's pretty hard to do on a local level, and sometimes you just have to go with your gut. And that means you have to understand who your customers are. That's why it's so important for the entrepreneur to be out there on the front line talking to his customers, interacting with the customers so that you know what they want, you understand them, and you get this feel for what it's like to be a customer in your business. And in understanding your customers, you also have to be careful about trying to please customers. And this can be a trap for the entrepreneur, because a lot of times we want to please the customers that we can attract. Like, what's the biggest audience? What's the biggest group of customers that we can bring into the business? And so let's create something that we can please those customers with. Instead, I think you ought to try to attract the customers that you can please. You have some core strengths, some core ideas. Use those to find some customers that you can please. And that means you have to understand your brand. Know what your brand is. Know what branding is. If you go back to this podcast, episode number 67, I ran down the small business branding checklist. So check that out at powertothesmallbusiness.com, episode number 67, the brand building checklist. But understand your brand, because your brand is what you advertise. I want to go back to what Emmanuel Brown said right towards the end there. He talked about building brand awareness and value over time by hitting key messages and building a larger perception in the audience's mind, building meaning for your business. And that requires some patience. Marketing is not an event. It's not a good idea. And so much of the advertising you see today, especially by the big brands, is marketing by good idea. You get an agency, they come up with this great idea, you think it's cute, it's funny, it's entertaining, yeah, let's do that, but there's no brand building going on. That's one of the reasons you should not pay attention to big brand advertising, because so much of it is bad. I brought up the Dodge Journey example, the beer advertising, especially Bud Light. That's just bad advertising, and it reveals at its core a lack of understanding of your brand. So in a lot of ways, it's good that you may not have a bunch of money to invest in your advertising or to hire an advertising agency, because you may then fall into the trap of marketing by good idea. Use common sense. Cute and creative advertising marketing is short-lived. It has no long-term brand value. So understand your brand at its core. And as Emmanuel said at the end there, build brand awareness and value over time. It's not about who you can attract today. It's the foundation that you're laying today to attract customers tomorrow and 1 year from now. And that's the discipline and the professionalism that's lacking in marketing today. A huge thank you to all my guests on the big show today. Stephen Denny out of Santa Cruz, California, Denny Marketing. Emmanuel Brown out of Portland. And Mike Wagner of White Rabbit out of Des Moines. I will post links to their websites in the show notes and lots of other good stuff. Check it out at powertothesmallbusiness.com. That's where you can also subscribe in iTunes or by email, so when the next episode is published, you get it automatically. My name is Jay Arrett. My website is themarketingspot.com. I'll catch you next time on the internet show that's all about small business marketing. Power to the small business.
You've been listening to Power to the Small Business with Jay Arrett, the internet show exclusively about small business marketing. Please see the complete show notes at themarketingspotblog.com. You can also listen to the show online and subscribe in iTunes at powertothesmallbusiness.com. Never miss an episode of the internet show all about small business marketing. Power to the small business.
And special thanks to Mary Lynn Foster of the Big Success Podcast for creating the opening and closing voiceovers of Power to the Small Business. You can find Mary Lynn at the Big Success Show, BIGGSuccess.com.